You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 270.
On today's show, we talk about Cahokia, Lake George, and ritual.
Let's dig a little deeper. But it's still going to be ritual.
It's always ritual.
It's always ritual. Welcome to the We Have No Followers on Our Instagram Account show.
Welcome to I Was Right.
So last week, if you're just joining us.
You're so butthurt over this.
I said, if we get to 1,000 followers, I didn't think it happened in a week, but I said, if we get to 1,000 followers on our Roadster Adventures Instagram account, which is kind of our RVing account, and we don't really have an archaeology show account, but we do share archaeology related things on there because we, as RVers and archaeologists, we like to visit historical things as well as just, you know, whatever we're doing. So it's kind of like a combo account. But I said, if we hit 1,000 followers on that account, that we would, you know, start an RVing podcast where we kind of focus on that kind of thing and just our travels rather than polluting this channel with that and this podcast with that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, seems like you guys don't love us in that way. And we've gained maybe 12 followers. So you guys love us. Thank you very much. But the rest of you,
I'm telling
just
you,
don't want it.
Look, please don't anybody take offense to this. I am a podcast listener. I understand that you're driving right now. You are running right now. You're working out. You're doing whatever you're doing, and you just don't have time. So I get it.
Yes.
But it would be cool if like you could come back to it later, but whatever. It's fine. I totally understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get back to our regularly scheduled programming and mm-hmm. our RV stuff. Mm-hmm. Although, I do have to say, historically speaking, we did go to Niagara Falls this last week.
We did.
Well, because we're here this week now.
Yes.
And we went and did the whole U.S. side of the thing on 4th of July.
Yep.
Independence Day in the United States here, for those of you who are not in the United States.
Yes.
Otherwise known as just the 4th of July.
But, you know. The fourth day of the month of July.
Right. I did see a little Instagram stat today, which so take that for a grain of salt. I didn't fact check it, but it said that like every 6 days on average, some country in this world celebrates its independence from Great Britain, and it's the most celebrated holiday on the planet. So there's that.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, Canada had their day, you know, 3 days before us, right?
Yeah, exactly.
July 1st, I think. So, yeah.
But anyway, first off, Niagara Falls, that where the Niagara River goes through, that gorge was much narrower than I thought it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I did not understand the layout of how these waterfalls were doing the thing that they do.
Right.
Because there's three of them, technically. And I was like, how can there be three? But like, basically what they're doing is these three waterfalls are dropping that water down from kind of from the American side to the river, which is the border between America or the U.S. and Canada. So
yeah, the only falls that's split by the international border is Horseshoe Falls.
Yeah.
Yeah, the border kind
of
goes right
through the
middle.
And most of it's on the Canada side. I was looking at the like the way the border goes.
One.
Most of it's Canada, just a little smidges America. Yeah. And then American Falls and Bridal Veil Falls, right? Or
yes,
that one is on.
Yeah, they call it Luna Falls, but also Bridal Veil Falls.
Oh,
that little one next to American Falls. Yeah,
that's the one that you can like walk right up, basically under, which we did.
Yeah,
and that was so cool,
crazy. Which you can see on our Instagram stories.
The stories which are gone now.
Well, I saved them as a little.
Oh, did you?
Highlight.
Okay,
yeah, so
okay,
you can still go to them if you follow us. So go there. Anyway,
enough about our travels.
No, I want to say historically speaking, because we did see a little video, and I thought this was really cool. Back in the 1800s, by the mid 1800s, like 1880s, give or take or so, there was a lot of industry, and practically all the falls there were completely just like bottled up by factories that were sitting at the edge of the edge of the falls there.
And like private land ownership that controlled access to the land around the falls.
Right.
So you couldn't actually really like enjoy it the way we did.
No, they were charging admission to go see certain things. And these factories were just taking in the water, using the power of the water and the river coming through there to, you know, run their factories. And then whatever byproduct was coming out was just being spit over the side. And it was all gross and disgusting. Well, a bunch of notable American and Canadian you know, scholars and industrialists and business people got together and were like, this has really kind of got to stop.
Yeah.
And they put together this whole kind of collective, and they really did some work to get all this just taken care of.
They like
and
bought all the land back basically from essentially these factories and other places that owned it.
Yeah. And they turned it into on definitely the U.S. side, and I guess on the Canadian side as well. On the U.S. side, it became the first U.S. state park ever.
Yeah.
Which led, they said, towards the national park system.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of paved the way to the national park system. Mm-hmm. That like that whole that
the whole idea of doing idea it, of it, I yeah, think. Yeah.
Of putting aside this whole thing as a park. Yeah. Right. So that I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, that was really neat. And I'm really glad about it because national and state parks are like some of my favorite places in this entire country. So
well, they've got this whole slogan called that says like the world changed here. And, you know, there were no national parks in the world before like the U.S. made a national park.
Yeah.
And if that's all started with New York creating a state park, then the world really did change there.
Yeah.
And then another thing that changed was they really did start with industrialized power here too, because Nikola Tesla basically invented AC power, and him and Westinghouse, who was another big powerful person at the time, got together and at one of the Pan American fairs, I can't remember which one, in Chicago or something like that. I can't remember which one.
I think it was Chicago.
It wasn't a World's Fair. It was a different fair. But anyway, at one of the fairs, they won the contract, essentially, to try this thing out. And they put together all these turbines. They did this whole thing. And they basically lit up Buffalo, which was 20 miles away, Buffalo, New York. And that, essentially, that transmission of electricity across distances is what revolutionized the world, essentially.
Yep.
Yeah, nobody'd ever done that before. And it really did change the world. So, and that was all from the power of water at Niagara Falls.
Yep.
So,
anyway. And there's a lot of power there, so it makes sense. And it's still providing power to this day, I believe. So,
which is interesting because there isn't actually turbines at Niagara Falls. There's not a dam there.
It's but up
there
the
is
river.
There is dams on the river.
Yeah.
And like we crossed over them. There's a lot of hydroelectric activity on the Niagara River. It's just not at the falls.
Yeah, they're not touching the falls. Yeah, they're letting them do their thing. So,
right. So.
Anyway, really, really cool part of the country. We've enjoyed our visit up here for sure. Yeah.
Anyway, another city that was real powerful, but then failed for who knows what reason, was Cahokia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was in, well, what's now East St. Louis, Illinois, I guess. But anyway, this article is from Newsweek. We found it on Apple News. You'll see the article in your show notes.
Mm-hmm.
But Cahokia is the name given to this Native American city that is across the Mississippi River from St. Louis, Missouri, in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the largest Native American city in North America.
Yeah, it was occupied from around 1050 CE, and it reached its peak about 50 years later. And then it went on from there for another couple hundred years until, well, we get to what happened to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the center of what's known as Mississippian culture, and that's just the name given to a certain type of culture. You know, archaeologists come up with these traits given to a culture, you know, when they invent the bow and arrow, or they have pottery, or they do a thing, right? Then we give this name to them, you know, and that becomes what the culture is known as. It's just like when you hear of somebody being known as Mississippian culture, you know certain attributes about the culture.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it was probably first identified in Mississippi or something like that, and that's
or across
how
the
it,
Mississippi River.
Or on the river, something like that. So that's how those names come about.
Well, the Mississippian culture was, again, identified probably locally somewhere and then spread
and
out
then spread
as this idea. So Mississippian culture was spread across the southeastern, eastern, and midwestern United States from the 8th century to the start of European contact.
Yeah. I mean, big, big group of people and all over the southeast. So we've definitely encountered it in the work that we did in that area.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
For sure.
For sure.
It's thought that up to tens of thousands of people lived in Cahokia at the height of its occupation.
Yeah.
Making it one of the largest settlements in the world at the time of its height.
Yeah. And that is one place that we have actually been to.
Yeah. We've been to the top of the Big Mound.
Not recently. There was a conference there a few years back and that's when we went, right?
It was when I was in grad school. I remember that one.
Because that was a long time ago.
It was my first Society for American Archaeology conference, if I'm not... No, it wasn't my first one. It was my first one in grad school.
Okay.
That's right. Because I remember I went to one before that, but
this
is the one I went to in grad school. So that must mean we drove up there from Georgia.
It must have been like 2010 then,
right? Somewhere around then.
Yeah, 9, 10.
I think it would have been 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, so must have been 2010. Ago. Yeah, it's been 14 years ago at this point.
Yeah, but it's still like sticks in your brain. You still remember it because there are these giant grassy mounds.
Yeah.
And there's paths all through and around on them. Yes, human made. And it's really crazy to visit it because the size of it is so gigantic. And then you imagine all the people that would have lived there. And it's just, it's really crazy how big it was, you know?
Yeah. And one thing, if you look it up, that you have to remember with all the people that live there is the mounds area. I mean, right now, wouldn't have held tens of thousands of people.
No.
This would have been like the ceremonial area, mm-hmm. and probably high up people, and honestly, like a town type of area.
Yeah.
And people would have lived in the surrounding areas. Yeah. But it would have supported tens of thousands of people.
Yeah. It was their central area for, you know,
yeah,
ritual, stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And two things that stick out in my mind when I think of visiting there is, one is we went up in the St. Louis Arch, mm-hmm. and you could see the tallest mound from Cahokia from the St. Louis Arch, and it was a ways away.
Oh, really? I don't remember
that.
Yeah,
I remember seeing the top of it, and I remember seeing the arch from the mount.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely remember that.
Yep.
And then also in the museum, and I have a love-hate relationship with museums, because museums, I feel like, are mostly poorly done. Mm-hmm. Like, when you just have a bunch of things in display cases with labels, it's doesn't teach me anything.
It is not interesting.
I just don't care.
Right?
Yeah. Right? Like, I just don't care. And when you just put no effort into it. Mm-hmm. But the dioramas and the life-size, like, people and huts and, mm-hmm. like, things and people doing real things that they have at this at the Cahokia Visitor Center was just probably the best one I've still to this date ever seen.
Quite interactive, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It was just, I always think about it when I think of visiting somewhere.
Really well done museum for sure. Yeah.
Anyway, by around 1400 CE, the city was nearly completely abandoned, and we still don't really know why.
Yeah. Now, potential factors could have included drought, flooding, climate change, overexploitation of resources, and sociopolitical instability. So basically anything. Basically anything that ever has caused a society to.
Right.
I'm not going to use the word collapse because we have decided to reject that word, and for good reason, because or abandon, collapse, disappear, all those words say something about a culture that we don't want to say. All we know is that the people left. They were not there anymore.
I think the word is in my notes somewhere because they used it in the article.
They did. They did. But we can go into that a little bit more. But basically, these were people who didn't necessarily, it's not like they all died, right? There wasn't a catastrophic event that killed everybody. It was
kind of what the article says here, too. Yeah, they didn't.
So anyway.
Now, one of the popular theories was depopulation driven by massive crop failure, mm-hmm. brought on by prolonged drought.
Yeah.
But the recent research that we're talking about here, which was published in the journal The Holocene, has cast doubt on that. And if you've never heard of the Holocene, that is basically the geological epoch that we're in now, mm-hmm. that is after the last glacial maximum, basically. Well, the last glacial time period.
Yeah.
So the Pleistocene.
Yeah, it's basically affected by humans, right? Like once humans appeared on Earth.
That's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So Natalie Mueller and Caitlin Rankin published that residents had other reasons to leave the city. It wasn't necessarily this.
Yeah. And obviously that makes sense, right? Because like people are still people. Even 1,000 years ago, people were, like a drought might have happened and it sucked, but they figured out ways around it, right?
Yeah. So what they were looking at was they took all these different theories that people had and they just started testing them. And they said, well, let's just take a look at one of these and see if we can't either prove it or disprove it.
Yeah.
And they took soil samples from around the site, including from some of the famous earthwork mounds. Mm-hmm. And they looked at carbon isotopes. And from these samples of carbon isotopes, when you look at those, these carbon isotopes represent plants growing in the area at the time. And this is when they said at the time of collapse, mm-hmm. or at the time of abandonment,
uh-huh.
or supposed abandonment, right? When nobody was living there anymore. And what they were looking for is, did you see different plants at that time?
Yeah.
Because if you see different plants at that time, what they would suggest is if there was a period of prolonged drought, you no longer see crops, the normal crops you would expect to see. You would see like prairie grasses and things like that that would have taken over in place of the crops.
Yeah.
But they just simply don't see that.
Yeah.
They still see crops.
Yeah.
They still see the normal stuff.
Still see what people were eating. So like obviously they were figuring out a way to get around the whole drought thing. I mean, they were probably controlling the water. what little that they did have. Like, there's probably a lot of ingenious ways that they had to keep their crops growing. Right.
Now, there was climate change at this time. It's pretty well documented around the planet. I think it's...
is this the Little Ice Age?
I'm not sure. Don't quote us on that.
Yeah.
But because it just kind of popped into my head. But there is a time around this time. It affected Chaco Canyon. Yes. It affected all kinds of things.
I thought that was the Little Ice Age.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But it affected
Europe and everything, too. Like, you see it in across the world.
During the Dark Ages.
Yeah,
it affected across the world. This was affected, right?
Yeah.
But they also say that, you know, residents here, this is a sophisticated city. They knew what they were doing. Mm-hmm. They probably could have handled themselves. It's not to say that people probably didn't die. It was a drought. There probably was some famine. There probably was some things like that. But it doesn't mean that, like, the whole city just failed.
Yeah.
But it probably does mean that some people probably left for greener pastures, so to speak. You know, they probably took off.
Yeah.
And the city probably did decline a little bit. But they said they probably managed their way through it.
Yeah. So. You know what this reminds me of? Like, you hear about these, like, sort of, especially in Asian countries that are growing rapidly, and their cities are growing rapidly, probably in India too, where there's this, like, mass exodus from the rural areas into the cities.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is just because people can simply make more money in the cities, right? So that's why they're doing that. But what that effectively does is leaves these, like, rural villages essentially abandoned and empty.
Yeah.
And it's not because anybody died. It's not because there was anything catastrophic. It was just that they're seeking opportunities elsewhere.
Right.
And you have to look at what's going on here and think, well, maybe something similar was going on. Maybe the younger people, the younger generation, were looking around and seeing a different opportunity elsewhere, and they chose to take it.
Yeah.
There's no reason why that couldn't have happened in a native culture too.
I mean, I'm willing to bet with just a handful of generations, if even less, of times of instability brought on by climate change and, you know, this drought and things like that. If you've got a couple of different rulers, maybe that just, you know, maybe one ruler handled it pretty well, and you get a couple of different rulers that just, like, don't handle it well.
Yeah.
That's enough to just say, just have people just abandon
it. Just, like, lose faith. And they're like, we gotta, grass is greener, right? Like, we gotta try this somewhere else. Maybe it'll be better. Don't know.
See you, bro.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, not that we're saying that that's exactly what happened, but I just think that the whole catastrophic thing that you can blame is just not really where archaeology is at these days. We're not looking for that smoking gun thing to blame abandonment of a city like this. It's not, it's more nuanced than that. I love these kind of studies to bring that nuance into the picture. So,
all right. Well, next, we're going to Lake George, where we're actually going soon, where half of your family's from, and where we hope to not catch smallpox. All right.
Okay.
Back in a minute.
It got dark.
Welcome back to episode 270 of the Archaeology Show, where we have 10 more followers than we did last week on Roadster Adventures.
You need to give it up, bro. It's enough.
I mean, I was thinking about starting a Archaeology Show Instagram, but I just don't have the energy to post on two different threads.
I know. We can barely keep up with Roadster Adventures. So
it's terrible.
I don't post anything on my personal or my yarn knitting one at all anymore.
All right.
Yeah.
Social media.
It's a lot.
With this riveting content, we'll definitely gain at least 7 more followers. All right.
Oh, God. Okay. So we're going over to Lake George, New York, a place that I am very familiar with because my dad is from the area and I grew up going there as a kid, and I spent a lot of time not on Lake George itself, but in the area. There's a smaller lake nearby that my dad is actually from. So I love the area. It's beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful area.
And because of algorithms and the fact that your phone is listening to you and all that stuff.
Right.
I actually saw this article. And I was like, well, we have to talk about it.
Yeah, like it served it right up to you. Like, oh, are you in New York currently? Are you going to be near this place? Here you go. Article just for you.
It's actually kind of a short little, you know, kind of like a little community college dig article kind of thing. I don't even think it's community college. It's just a little thing. But I don't know. I thought it was kind of interesting.
It's cool that we're going to this place. Yeah. And there's some archaeological work that's happening like right in that area. So now we know about it. But
so.
All right. So Lake George. For those that aren't familiar, it is on the eastern edge of New York State along the border with Vermont. It's this long, skinny lake. It's been carved out by glaciers, like basically all the lakes in that area have been. On the south end of the lake is the Lake George Battlefield Park, and that is one of the longest continually occupied military sites in American history.
Yep.
It has a wonderful history where over 2,000 patients suffered from smallpox. Yep. So must have been kind of like a quarantining kind of thing.
It was a hospital.
Yeah, it must have been.
Yeah. So archaeologists from Skidmore College, which I've heard of before and always thought was like the worst name ever. But anyway, and volunteers. I just don't like it. I don't know.
Okay.
Volunteers, right. They resumed excavations this year at the site after the last dig in 2016 by the late David Starbuck from SUNY Adirondack.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he died sometime between now and then.
I think they said he died of cancer a few years back. And so
something like that, yeah.
There's not been any work at this area since he passed away because it was sort of his baby, his project or whatever. And yeah, so, but they've gone back this field season mm-hmm. to do some more work.
Yeah, so the site was of a large military encampment during the French and Indian War, the 1755 Battle of Lake George, and later, 1776, the General Hospital at Fort George, and the largest smallpox hospital in North America at the time. So they were literally sending people here with smallpox.
Yeah.
Because apparently they knew how to handle it. Or not.
Or just kept them away from everybody else. I mean, you know, they knew at a certain point that it was very contagious, right? So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And so just this past June, students and volunteers excavated at the north end of the park near where the 1750s military barracks were built.
Yeah, they actually thought they were digging inside or perhaps just adjacent to one that mm-hmm. may have housed smallpox patients. And they thought they were in there. And they were digging in this spot because they had done some ground-penetrating radar studies first.
Mm-hmm.
And the GPR studies showed what they thought were like metallic anomalies. They mm-hmm. thought it was metal. They thought it was some other things. So they decided to dig there.
Mm-hmm.
What they found was beer caps and pull tabs.
Oh, my God. When I read that, I absolutely died because that's like 70s era trash,
yeah.
right? Do you know who was running around
dad.
In the 70s,
like
drinking beers and pulling tabs? Yeah, my dad.
Definitely him.
Definitely my dad.
Sitting down on a military park.
Yeah. Right? I could totally see him doing that. In fact, we're going to see him tomorrow. I'm going to ask him about it. Like, hey, dad, do you remember like going to this spot with your friends and drinking like sometime in the mid to late 70s? Oh, man. Oh, I hope God. He says yes, because I'm not going to tell him why I'm asking.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yep. Yeah. Anyway, so but, obviously this GPR anomaly was unfortunately not related to the older occupation yeah. of the site. It was the modern occupation of the site, I suppose.
Right. And ground penetrating radar is kind of limited in the sense that it can't see below that kind of stuff.
Right.
But to their credit, they kept digging.
Yeah.
And as they dug deeper, they did find possibly butchered cows, sheep, or pig bones.
Yeah.
It seemed to be some kind of a trash pit, and they feel like it was about an 18th century one. So, you know, we're getting down into the right time frame here.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, they're just maybe assuming it was 18th century because they're saying, was there anything else here between then and, you mm-hmm. know, Rachel's dad, like, you know, drinking. So
my dad partying it up.
Right. So we had smallpox patients yep. and then Rachel's dad and
yeah.
his buddies.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So anyway, the goal with this year's dig was to just collect information and help manage, interpret, and better protect the site going forward. And I'll tell you what, the real goal of this was to probably train field school students. And they always yeah. need some place to go, and you like to have some place that's real.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a dig like this on a park, on a place that really could use the research and could
yeah.
use the help, probably doesn't have a lot of money. They probably did mm-hmm. this for free. There was volunteers helping as well.
Yeah.
It's just a good community public effort, and it also gives students a nice real thing to actually work on.
Yeah,
so
totally.
My guess is that's the real reason why they were digging here, but also has an honest community benefit as well.
So the excavation was run by Siobhan Hart, and it sounds like it's unclear why she ended up even doing this dig, because she very clearly said that she probably won't come back. So
yeah.
I wonder if it was like a one-off situation where maybe the park needed the work done and they found, you know, through their resources who they could get to come and do it and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to do more work, they're going to have to fundraise and get that together in order to make that happen, it sounds like. So it's interesting how this came about. But, you know, and maybe if they had found stuff that was a little bit more interesting than just, you know, beer pull tabs from the 70s and some possibly butchered bones. And,
yeah.
you know, the end result of this article is actually a little bit of a letdown, because it's like, oh, so they kind of found nothing. Wah, wah. But more work, right? Like, there's always more work to do. There's always somewhere else to look. There's always something else you could do. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll see if they end up returning and having more luck next time.
Yep. Well, sometimes when you don't find something in archaeology, it just means nothing happened right there.
Yeah.
And that's just actually good information sometimes.
Yep. You gotta gotta cross it off your list. Like, okay, they weren't here. Where's the next place to look?
Yep.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, get your drinks out. Go pour yourself a tall one, whether it's a glass of wine, glass of water, whatever you want, because about to play the ritual drinking game on the other side, Australia style.
Ritual!
Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 270, and I hope you got your drink. Like I said, it doesn't have to be alcoholic, but just a drink.
You know, stay hydrated. You know, get some water.
Yeah. I don't care. Maybe tea. I don't know. Who knows? I mean, if you drink tea instead of coffee, though, we probably can't be friends. But otherwise.
Excuse me.
No, we probably can't
Are you friends with Tilly?
I know. But but still, though, seriously, Tilly, I've got some coffees that'll change your life.
Oh, my God.
So, anyway. So, yes, this article is called 12,000-year-old ritual passed down 500 generations, maybe the world's oldest. And I got to tell you, I'm standing there looking at amazing waterfalls on 4th of July.
Yeah.
Independence Day. Yep. And this just starts pinging me.
Yes.
On my watch and my phone.
I saw it on my phone. I saw it on my watch. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I know what the next article we're going to talk about when we record tomorrow
is. We have
to
talk about it. So.
But it's a good one. I was really super interested in this. So, yeah.
So
this is based on an actual peer-reviewed study. It was published in the Nature magazine human behavior, like, subcategory of Nature.
Yeah.
And we'll have the link in the show notes. I'm pretty sure it was open source, so you could go check it out. You can at least see the figures, even if it wasn't. So, yeah.
Yeah, the article subtitle is, "Buried deep in an Australian cave, archaeologists have uncovered evidence that an Aboriginal ritual may have been passed down 500 generations and survived 12,000 years, making it the oldest known continuous cultural practice in the world, according to a new study." That's a hell of a subtitle.
It really is. And I was like, man, those are some extraordinary claims. And as the great Carl Sagan said, they better have some extraordinary evidence to go along with that. And I have to say, I'm actually pretty impressed with it. So we'll get to it. So this is coming from excavations in Clogs Cave, which is approximately 217 miles or 350 kilometers east of Melbourne. Australia, that is. We are on the continent of Australia.
Yes. Not Melbourne, Ohio.
Nope. If there is one, I don't know.
There might be.
Maybe.
It could be.
Who knows?
Yeah. Researchers found a piece of wood protruding from the ground that they dated to 12,000 years using radiocarbon dating.
Yes.
It's very unusual for a wood artifact to last that long, so they were pretty excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they found another piece of wood, a little wooden stick, in the same cave that was very similar to the first and dated that to 11,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So 1,000 years apart. Now, that's instantly kind of throws up a red flag for me, although I didn't read the peer-reviewed article to find out exactly what the years were and what the error range was, because radiocarbon dating could have some error bars there that are putting them close to each other.
Yeah, definitely could, but it is interesting. It's the same cave, right?
Yeah.
1,000 years difference between them, so.
Yeah.
And get this, both sticks were smeared with animal or human fat. I've got a big WTF around that. Like, where are you getting human fat from? Are you like dipping under somebody's surface, like skin, to like grab a little scoop of human fat? Like,
plenty
what?
Of dead humans around 11,000 years ago.
Oh my God, that's terrible. Yep. But I guess, you know, ritual.
Yep.
Anyway, so the sticks that were smeared with this fat were found near what they are calling miniature fireplaces that had been fleetingly burnt.
Yeah.
And you really can see what they're talking about when you look at the picture, because you can see like a stick and then the end of it has this sort of charred, burned end, you know, just on the end of it. It's not anywhere else, and it doesn't seem to be a larger fire pit necessarily. So, yeah.
Yeah, these were originally found during excavations about 50 years ago, and they did not, this is kind of important to the story, but they did not consult local Aboriginal groups about their findings.
Yeah.
Probably back in a time when nobody consulted local Aboriginal groups about their findings.
Nope, didn't happen here in the States. I'm sure it didn't happen in Australia either. So, yeah, not so much.
Yeah, the wooden sticks weren't analyzed in any detail at that time, and nobody really cared about them too much.
Yeah, I don't know what they thought of them. I mean, they didn't even do the carbon dating back then, I don't think. They might not have even known that they were that old.
I don't think they had carbon dating back then.
Oh, yeah, they probably didn't. No, not in the 70s.
Not 50 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was invented.
It was the beginnings of it, right?
Not for they weren't using it for archaeology, though.
Oh, okay.
Not in the 70s.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, in fact, I think carbon dating was technically invented in, like, the 50s or 60s or something, but it definitely wasn't used for archaeology until maybe even the 90s.
Okay, gotcha. So, well, that makes sense because they were basically just tucked away. You know, we've got these great pictures that are in the article, so they knew what it looked like in situ or whatever, and then they had the artifacts, of course. But
yeah.
So the story doesn't pick up again until 2017 when Bruno David, a professor at the Monash Indigenous Studies Center, was approached by the Gunai Krenai people to investigate the site and those artifacts kind of specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, they were interested in how these sticks with burnt ends could be related to a 19th century ritual that was documented by Alfred Howitt, who was a geologist and ethnographer back at that time.
Yeah. Howitt had documented rituals that were performed by powerful Gunai Krenai wizards, or medicine men and women, in Clogg's Cave in the 1880s.
And that was his word, I think.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
They had it in quotes in the
yeah,
article.
He called them wizards and yeah, all that stuff. He said they were super powerful. And they did these rituals to either harm an enemy or heal a sick person. They would take something belonging to the target and attach it to a throwing stick along with human or animal fat. Then the stick was stuck slanting into the ground before a fire in a position that over time would fall down.
Yeah.
The recent analysis of data also found that the cave had almost exclusively been used for ritual purposes because there's no evidence of vertebrate food remains. So no other use of the cave whatsoever.
Yeah.
So the crazy thing about this whole thing is they kind of still do this today. Or they have evidence, ethnographic evidence that they've done this recently.
Yeah, like 150 years ago they were doing it.
Well, at least 150 years ago.
Yeah.
They're not kind of saying they don't do this now, but at least 150 years ago they were doing this.
Yes.
And 12,000 years ago they were doing this.
So I'm like, do you make the leap and connect something that happened 11 or 12,000 years ago with what was happening 150 years ago? Do we really think that that's an unbroken chain of passing down a ritual from one person or group to another? Or is it just that humans like kind of do similar things in general, and it could have just grown out of a different culture in a different time, the same or similar practice?
What's real interesting to me is that, you know, you see, always see in movies where something starts out small and then just gets blown way out of proportion. Mm-hmm. You know, it just like it starts really tiny and then, you know, grows into this huge thing. I mean, let's just take modern religion, right? Starts out as this guy in the Middle East just going, hey, be nice to each other. And now we've got, you know, huge crazy churches and all these ridiculous rituals and robes, right?
Yeah.
Like, where did all that come from?
Yeah.
That didn't start in the Middle East,
right?
So why did this not change in 12,000 years?
Yeah, why did this same exact thing happen across that large amount of time?
Well, and not only that, but like how long was it going on before that?
Yeah.
You know, like was this going on for 12,000 years before this?
Yeah.
Like, where did this actually start? You know what I mean? So it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is interesting to imagine that. That is one reality, is that yes, it was just handed down from person to person to person throughout the millennia, right?
Yeah.
Like that is absolutely possible. It's just, I don't think it's the only way that it could have happened. There's definitely other ways, which is it just sprouted up in different areas.
I don't know.
Different
it's
times.
So, it's so specific.
It is very specific.
Yeah. I'd have a hard time believing that.
Yeah.
But that being said,
but you can believe easier that it handed down.
I could believe that
over 12,000 years.
I could believe that.
Really?
It's such a specific thing. As long as the people were there and there was not an unbroken chain in the population and that, you know, these kinds of things, I mean, they really are sacred to people. So if you've got a way to hand something down and it is sacred enough that and believed enough, as long as people believe it works, they're not going to mess with it.
Yeah.
They are going to pass that down and it is not going to be changed.
Yeah.
Which is kind of why I think other religions change so much. I don't think anybody think it works. You know what I mean?
Well, they think they can do it better, so they
exactly, because they don't think it works.
Yeah.
You know, that's why things change and they get moved and they get, but I think somebody thinks this works.
Yeah.
And therefore they believe in it, you know? That's why you get some of those kind of black arts, they call them, you know, like voodoo and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, people really believe in that stuff.
Yeah.
And it changes. It doesn't change very often.
Right.
Because people don't mess with it. They don't use it very often because they're afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they really think it works.
But people are still people and they put their personal spins on things. They make it slightly different. They make, you know, like people are still creative in whatever way they're doing their, they have an outlet and this would be one, right? So well, maybe I just find it hard to believe that it would be.
Well, maybe the creativity comes in the size of the fire, the length of the stick or the fat or the things like that. But the general shape and size of the ritual is hard to change.
I'm also like, why can't you tell whether it was human or animal fat? Is that because 12,000 years, it's just too degraded?
Just not be enough left. Maybe you can't tell the difference between fat that well. There's not enough DNA that's left.
That's true. Yeah, that's possible.
Or maybe they just haven't done that analysis yet.
Yeah, true.
Or maybe when it was collected 50 years ago, it wasn't collected in the right way.
Oh, it could have been contaminated by humans touching it. Yeah, that's absolutely possible for sure.
It may have had animal fat on it, and now it has human fat on it.
Right.
Because they just like picked it up and licked it, because that's what archaeologists do.
Yeah.
They just lick artifacts. What is this? Is it bone or wood? Let me lick it.
Oh, God. Why do we do that? Stop doing that. Don't do it. There's other ways to tell. You don't need to lick it.
You know what you should do instead? You should follow us on Instagram. All right. That's it. How many times do we say ritual? Are you even conscious right now?
Well, I have been drinking wine, but
like our listeners.
Oh, I was just like making the argument for me being conscious. Still.
Oh, right. Yeah. So
I'm talking to you.
Well, if our listeners are still conscious, if you're like just hammered drunk right now, you may as well just go to Instagram and follow us.
I'm telling you, they're all driving or working out.
Oh, that's
true. That's the only time people listen to podcasts.
Nobody works out to us.
I work out to like whatever podcast comes on. Right.
Oh,
so,
well, yeah, I guess
it wouldn't be us.
Right.
But.
Well, if you're driving, here's your exit. All right. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.